On this edition for Saturday, November 16th, after a week of hearings, key takeaways from the impeachment inquiry. And in our signature segment, the latest in our Future of Food series with a look at kernza, a little-known grain that's gaining attention. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
From the Tisch WNET studios at Lincoln Center in New York, Karina Mitchell.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. Today, a White House official who may have knowledge of why hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to Ukraine was withheld in July defied administration orders not to testify and appeared before a closed-door impeachment inquiry on Capitol Hill. Mark Sandy, Deputy Associate Director in the Office of Management and Budget's National Security Division, complied with a subpoena. Other administration officials have ignored congressional subpoenas to testify. Sandy was reportedly the OMB official who signed paperwork that enforced a hold on nearly $400 million in military and security aid. One focus in the impeachment inquiry is whether Mr. Trump withheld aid to pressure Ukraine to announce an investigation into former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter. The president kept up a stream of Twitter attacks on the impeachment inquiry, including one this morning that misspelled Representative Adam Schiff's name in a way that made it look like an obscenity and claimed impeachment would cause, quote, the biggest fall in market history, a depression, not a recession. Yesterday, Mr. Trump live-tweeted criticism of the former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, during her testimony.
What effect do you think that has on other witnesses' willingness to come forward and expose wrongdoing?
Well, it's very intimidating.
The president later said he was exercising his right to free speech. Democrats called it witness intimidation. After the public hearing yesterday, congressional committee members and staff questioned David Holmes, a foreign service officer at the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine, in a private session. According to written testimony first obtained by CNN, Holmes said he overheard a phone call between the president and the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, on July 26. Holmes said he heard Mr. Trump ask if Ukraine's president had agreed to investigate the Bidens and that Sondland responded saying yes. For more on today's developments and the public testimony this week, Politico reporter Heather Cagle joins us from Washington, D.C. Let me ask you, what does Mark Sandy's testimony about withholding military aid add to the case Democrats are trying to make for impeachment?
Sandy is actually a very important witness because he's the first official from the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, to respond to a congressional subpoena and show up. House investigators subpoenaed three other OMB officials, including the acting director, in recent weeks, and they all refused to testify. They didn't even come up here. So Sandy is important for Democrats because he can perhaps shed some light on just how the military aid that the U.S. had promised to Ukraine, how that got frozen over the summer, where the directive came from, how closely the president was involved. These are all questions that Democrats have had a hard time getting answers from because the OMB officials previously subpoenaed hadn't testified. And so they're hoping that Sandy, who was pretty closely involved, at least initially, in the freezing of the aid, can help shed some light on these questions.
And certainly it was aid that was very necessary for Ukraine. Help us understand why that nearly $400 million in aid was so vital to Ukraine.
Well, so Ukraine is fighting off Russian aggression right now, and the military aid from the U.S. is what Ukraine is relying on to do that. And they count on that money. And remember, the money had already been appropriated by Congress. So Ukraine assumed that that $391 million in aid was coming to them. And so when, you know, questions started to arise about this being frozen, where was the aid, things like that, that's when some OMB officials like Sandy started kind of internally sounding an alarm from what we have heard. And Ukraine started to get anxious. And the military aid is really the heart of Democrats' investigation because they claim that President Trump used it as leverage to try to bribe Ukraine into opening an investigation into Joe Biden.
Let me switch gears a little bit. Late yesterday, we learned that David Holmes, a U.S. aide in Ukraine, said behind closed doors he revealed he overheard President Trump with Ambassador Sondland on the phone asking about an investigation, and Sondland's response essentially that Zelensky would do anything for Trump. What wrench does that throw into the Republican rhetoric that this testimony so far has been sort of irrelevant, or there is no smoking gun that's emerged from any of the witnesses that have testified this week?
So Mr. Holmes really undercuts a key part of the Republican defense, which is that all of the witnesses that have testified thus far and a lot of the evidence that Democrats have gathered to present against the president is all quote-unquote hearsay. It's things that officials, senior diplomats, have heard secondhand. Well, Mr. Holmes was sitting next to Gordon Sondland at this restaurant in Ukraine, and he says that he heard the president on the phone asking about these investigations and was told by Sondland after the call that by investigations, President Trump meant investigation into Biden. And so this is not hearsay. This is a firsthand account of a senior official hearing the president ask about Biden being investigated by Ukraine. And so that really undercuts the Republican defense that all Democrats have is hearsay, and they don't really have anything directly tying President Trump to this pressure campaign on Ukraine.
And the pressure is mounting on Republicans. I want to go to President Trump's decision to attack Marie Yovanovitch on Twitter while she was testifying yesterday. That was really remarkable. How badly did that backfire? Because Republicans offered no support after he tweeted that message out, and Democrats are calling it witness intimidation.
Yeah, so there was actually a break in the hearing after President Trump tweeted his attack. Chairman Adam Schiff read the tweet to Yovanovitch, and then she responded. There was a break for House votes before the hearing resumed again. And so several Republicans, you know, on their way to the House floor said privately that they were dumbfounded by this tweet. This is kind of their worst nightmare. Trump is a very unpredictable president, and they had spent all week preparing for this hearing and encouraging their lawmakers on the committee to not attack Yovanovitch because she's a very well-respected senior diplomat. And they did not want to be looking like they were trying to discredit her while they were trying to discredit Democrats' investigation. And so President Trump came out and did the exact opposite of that. And not only did he do that, but he did it mid-hearing. And so Republicans really didn't know how to respond. We saw that, as you said, they didn't defend the tweet. And then once the hearing resumed, all of them who were asking her questions really took care to heap praise on her and her career. And I think that was kind of to try to help ease the pain that they thought that this tweet inflicted.
And finally, I just want to ask you really quickly, how do you think Democrats have handled this situation this week? We saw the messaging change from quid pro quo to bribery. Is any of this really resonating with ordinary Americans enough for them to sort of change their viewpoint?
According to Democrats, yes, they have done some focus groups in very competitive districts that they need to hold on to next year to keep the House. And bribery and extortion are words that really cut through the noise for voters, much more so than quid pro quo. And so they think by pivoting to those kind of words that they'll be able to help make their case easier to voters who are still undecided.
And many more words and more witnesses to come next week. Heather Cagle from Politico, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
President Trump is staying in Washington this weekend. This afternoon, he left the White House to begin his annual physical exam at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. The annual exam was not announced in advance. In a statement, Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham said only, quote, anticipating a very busy 2020, the president is taking advantage of a free weekend here in Washington, D.C. to begin portions of his routine annual physical exam at Walter Reed. The 16-year-old boy who killed two classmates and wounded three others at his Southern California high school on Thursday died yesterday afternoon. The teenager died of a self-inflicted gunshot from the last round he fired. The victims were identified as 15-year-old Gracie Ann Muehlberger and 14-year-old Dominic Blackwell. Police say they still have no motive for the mass shooting. The White House announced late last night that President Trump intervened in three cases of military service members who were accused or convicted of war crimes. The president issued full pardons to two Army officers. First Lieutenant Clint Lawrence, who was found guilty of two counts of murder and had served 7 years, was released from prison last night and reunited with family members. Army Green Beret Major Matthew Goldstein faced a charge of murdering an Afghan man during his deployment in 2010. In the third case, President Trump restored the military rank of Navy SEAL Edward Gallagher, who was acquitted of murder charges but convicted of taking photos with a captive's dead body in Iraq earlier this year. A Texas court last night halted the scheduled execution of death row inmate Rodney Reed, whose case has garnered public attention. The Court of Criminal Appeals announced it suspended Reed's death sentence indefinitely and ordered new evidence to be considered in the case. Reed was charged for the 1996 murder of Stacy Stites through DNA evidence. His attorneys argue they have new evidence to back up his claims of innocence. Reed had been scheduled to die by lethal injection on Wednesday. His case will now turn to the original trial court where he was convicted two decades ago. In Louisiana today, voters are deciding the race for governor in a runoff election. The incumbent Democrat John Bel Edwards is facing Republican Eddie Rasponi, a businessman who tied his campaign to support for President Trump. Mr. Trump's campaign for Rasponi repeatedly in Louisiana and tweeted at voters this morning to, quote, get out and vote for the Republican. Bel Edwards is the only Democratic governor in the Deep South. Polls close in Louisiana at 8 p.m. local time. Former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick is trying out for a spot in the league after nearly 3 years away from football. Kaepernick, who was criticized for kneeling during the national anthem to protest what he said was racial and social injustice, played his last season in 2016 with the San Francisco 49ers before becoming a free agent. He later sued the NFL for conspiring to keep him out of the league. That grievance was settled in February. The NFL said that at least a dozen teams signed up to attend Kaepernick's tryout in Atlanta today and that video of the workout would be available for the teams who were not able to attend. Protesters took to the streets of Paris today on the one-year anniversary of the start of the so-called Yellow Vest movement. Police used tear gas and water cannons on demonstrators who set fires and broke windows. The Yellow Vest protests are largely focused on President Emmanuel Macron's economic policies, which demonstrators say favor the wealthy. Police detained over 100 people by late afternoon, and more than 70 were fined for protesting in a forbidden area. And we will have more international news coming up later in the broadcast. For live results of the Louisiana governor's race, visit pbs.org/newshour. Our Future of Food series continues with a look at a little-known grain and high hopes for its future. PBS NewsHour weekend special correspondent Mark Bittman introduces the story.
Industrial agricultural practices are leading causes of water pollution and climate change. But it turns out farming could also be part of the solution. Scientists are developing a type of grain they say has a host of environmental benefits. And is pretty tasty, too. NewsHour Weekend's Megan Thompson has more. This report is supported in partnership with the Pulitzer Center.
Carmen Fernholz has farmed corn, soy, and small grains in western Minnesota his whole life. He was an early adopter of organic methods in the 1970s, so he wasn't surprised when a researcher from the University of Minnesota approached him 8 years ago, asking if he'd be willing to plant an experimental grain.
And I says, you know me, I like to try anything once. And so he got me enough seed to plant about 2 acres. From then on, it was just a matter of experimenting.
Fernholz was one of the first farmers to plant kernza, a type of wheatgrass genetically similar to the wheat most of us currently eat. This is the first grain cultivated for human consumption that's a perennial plant rather than an annual.
So an annual plant is a plant that lives for 1 year and then dies.
Agronomist Lee DeHaan has pioneered the development of kernza at the Land Institute, a research nonprofit in Kansas. He explains that some of the fruits and vegetables we eat are perennials, plants that come back year after year without replanting. But the grains we eat, which cover the majority of our farmland, those are pretty much all annuals.
Wheat, corn, soybeans, rice, all these plants live for a fairly short period of time and then die when we harvest them.
Annual grains only have 1 year to reproduce before they die, so they grow quickly and produce a lot of big seeds. And that's probably why our ancestors started cultivating and eating them. But planting new seeds every spring is costly and time-consuming for farmers.
We have to do this process of clearing the ground and wiping out everything to allow these annual crops to get started.
It often involves tilling the land, turning it over to plant new seeds. That can damage it and release carbon stored in the soil into the atmosphere, contributing to climate change. And because the plants die in the fall, the land often has nothing growing on it for several months a year.
When that happens, you have bare soil, you're going to have the opportunity for erosion. So rain falling on that landscape washes soil away.
Nutrients in the soil wash away too, which can cause groundwater contamination. On the other hand, perennial plants stay in the ground for years. They have deep roots that protect the soil and hold nutrients in place. And those roots help trap carbon.
As we want to take carbon out of the atmosphere to mitigate climate change, as we want to restore soil health and soil quality, we find that really essential piece of that is a really deep, extensive root system, and that really comes with a perennial plant that's going to live in that ground for many years.
So back in the 1980s, scientists decided to try to create a perennial grain with all those environmental benefits that could also produce lots of seeds to feed humans like an annual. They started with a plant called intermediate wheatgrass, used mostly to feed cattle, and spent the next 3 decades selectively breeding it for the most desirable traits, like high yields and big seeds. Today, the new strains are trademarked Kernza.
There are dozens of researchers around the world working on developing Kernza, but the largest research program is located here at the University of Minnesota in St. Paul.
Agronomist Jake Jungers helps lead the work here in coordination with the Land Institute. He showed us a poster demonstrating how Kernza has a vast root system compared with an annual wheat plant.
How many feet long is this approximately?
In this image, the root system is about 9 feet.
Wow.
Jungers is conducting experiments in 25 fields around Minnesota and working with farmers like Carmen Fernholz to figure out how to make Kernza a commercially viable crop. But there are a lot of challenges. First, an acre of Kernza only yields about 25% of what an acre of regular wheat does, and those yields drop off dramatically after 2 or 3 years. Another issue, the top of the plant that contains the seeds is so long, the seeds ripen at different times.
By the time this bottom kernel is ripe and ready to harvest, the top is shattered and fallen on the ground already because it's been ripe too long. And so how do you make a good judgment on the most opportune time to harvest? There we got some kernels right there.
Another problem, the size of the seeds.
The kernel itself is a miniature wheat. And when I say miniature, it is miniature.
So Fernholz must carefully adjust his combine in order to harvest it. Through selective breeding, agronomists have approximately doubled the seed size, but that's created another problem.
We've increased seed size so much that the plant has a hard time holding up those larger seed heads and larger seeds, so it falls over.
And that interrupts pollination and makes it hard to harvest. Jungers says it will take a lot more work to address all these issues.
We're not sure how far away we are. It could be 15 years, it could be 30 years. Right now, progress is really rapid.
While agronomists work on those problems, University of Minnesota food scientists like Meisen Liu are studying how Kernza cooks up in the kitchen and analyzing its nutritional value.
It's superior in its fiber content, has higher protein, which is very much desirable in consumers today.
Liu says compared with traditional wheat, Kernza can also have 10 times the amount of antioxidants, which can prevent cell damage in humans. All this information will be valuable for food companies and consumers when or if Kernza ever hits the market widely. But before that can happen, there are more questions.
How are you going to convince farmers to plant this?
One of the benefits of a perennial crop is that it requires fewer inputs, which means fewer economic investments. So you plant the seed once, and you could potentially get a crop for 3, 4, 5 years. The Kernza also requires fewer herbicides, less nitrogen fertilizer.
Doesn't there also have to be a market for the farmer to sell to?
Yes, definitely. We can't just push a new crop on the landscape without a market. And as we develop the new crops, we're also developing the market and the supply chain.
One way Jungers doing that is working with small purveyors in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. One of the first restaurants to cook with Kernza was the Birchwood Cafe in Minneapolis. It's known for using local sustainable and organic ingredients.
The first thing we did with it was to put it in pancakes.
Tracy Singleton is Birchwood's founder.
There was no recipes for how to work with Kernza, like what ratio to use. What's the gluten content, any of that stuff. So it was really, it was a lot of experimenting by our bakers and our chefs back in the kitchen.
Today, Singleton's bakers and chefs put Kernza in everything from crackers to desserts to grain salads.
The grain is nice and crunchy. It's got a nice chew to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out Kernza's great for brewing. Another local pioneer is Sandy Boss Febo of the Bang Brewing Company in St. Paul. She's put four Kernza beers on tap.
Kernza has a bit of an earthy characteristic. It's a beautiful grain.
Promoters say Kernza beer helped change the game in 2016 when outdoor gear giant Patagonia started selling it in stores like Whole Foods, bringing the grain to the mainstream market. And last spring, General Mills, one of the biggest food corporations in the world, produced a Kernza cereal. Carla Fernan is president of the company's natural and organic unit.
We want to be an inspiration to other big players. We want to be a support network for farmers.
What do you think?
Really crunchy, just a little bit sweet.
Mm-hmm.
That's really good.
Good.
But there are hurdles, like a very limited supply. Only about 100 farmers are growing Kernza in the whole country. Vernon planned to sell honey-toasted Kernza in a handful of small grocery stores.
But that first crop of Kernza that we were excited when we were harvesting it, we were ready to turn it into cereal, about 95% of that crop failed. And I'm going to tell you the truth, there were some tears in our offices here.
So General Mills introduced a limited edition version online with the profits going to Kernza Research. Despite the setback, Vernon says the company plans to introduce more Kernza products with the goal of making them widely available by 2040. In the meantime, Kernza researchers are plowing ahead, and farmers like Carmen Fernholz remain committed too. In August, he harvested about 12,000 pounds of organic Kernza, which he sold to a specialty food processing company. But Fernholz says for him, it's about much more than making a profit.
If I can develop a crop that really cuts back on the soil disturbance and yet is a great revenue-producing crop and a food crop besides, to me, it becomes a win-win-win for everybody.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend Saturday.
In Iran, at least one person is dead in protests that erupted after authorities announced a 50% increase in gas prices and rationing of fuel. Protesters blocked traffic in Tehran and police fired tear gas to disperse crowds. Iranian officials said gas subsidies were reduced in favor of monthly subsidies for low-income families. In Hong Kong today, there was an unusual deployment of Chinese troops to assist cleanup efforts. Soldiers from the People's Liberation Army came out of a nearby barracks to remove bricks and other obstacles that had been interrupting the flow of traffic. China maintains a garrison of about 10,000 soldiers in Hong Kong and has threatened to deploy them against demonstrators. Today's cleanup happened while Hong Kong police battled with anti-government protesters who've been occupying Hong Kong's universities for about 1 week. In Bolivia, as many as 8 people were killed and more than 100 others injured last night during mass demonstrations. Security forces opened fire on supporters of Evo Morales, Bolivia's former president, who resigned Sunday after weeks of protests over the legitimacy of his election. The violence threatens the interim government's ability to secure peace until new presidential elections can be held. Morales was granted asylum in Mexico this week and is calling the interim government a, quote, dictatorship. Voters in Sri Lanka headed to the polls today to pick their next president. 35 candidates are in the race, and the current president is not running for re-election. The front runner's campaigns largely focused on national security and religious extremism. On Easter Sunday this year, a local Islamic extremist group killed 269 people in a coordinated bomb attack at multiple hotels and Christian churches. This is Sri Lanka's third presidential election since the end of its civil war in 2009.